Welcome to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Our team's goal is to present science-based information about gardening and all things nature in New York's Hudson Valley. Host Gene and Tim, along with team members Teresa and Linda, are master gardener volunteers for New York's Columbia and Greene counties. So if you're interested in gardening or nature or nuggets of information about what's happening outside your door, settle in. Enjoy the conversation. Whatever the season, we have something to say.
Hi, I'm Tim Kennelty.
Hi, I'm Gene Thomas.
And welcome to another edition of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We have an exciting guest today, one of our favorite people, right? Joe Bain from Bain's Best Perennials.
He's a wholesale grower, so you can't go to his place, but you can go to any of the retailers that he supplies.
And it's the perfect time of year because it's officially spring, right?
Yay.
It's officially spring. So we're really going to start thinking about planting perennials. Yeah, Joe is really a perennial expert, so we're going to talk to him all about his favorites and how he grows them and what's really a durable perennial and native perennials and all of that good stuff.
Joe knows more than anybody I know about perennials. In fact, he's even taught some of the Master Gardener classes and is always very generous to the Master Gardeners.
And also in this episode, we have another edition of my Good Plant, Bad Plant.
So today's topics are Monarda and stiltgrass.
Yeah, you probably have Monarda and stiltgrass in your property,
oh,
right?
Oh, no doubt. I like them both, unfortunately.
Oh, that's bad. That's bad. Monarda is like one of my favorite plants because it's in the mint family, so nobody eats it. Mm-hmm. It's an amazing pollinator plant, and the hummingbirds love it as well.
I have a hummingbird that comes to my house and visits one particular Monarda flower in front of my porch, and I sit and watch him go from one little floret to another.
And then the bad plant is Japanese stiltgrass, which some people don't even know they have it, but it's a really bad invasive plant. So hopefully people will learn a little bit about that as well.
Yeah, it's another one of those seductive sneak-in kind of invasives.
It does sneak in. The seeds sneak in on the tires of lawnmowers and on cars. I always say know your foe as far as invasives, so this is one you really want to know about. Also in this episode is another edition of Hits and Myths. I love hits and myths because I always think that some of these things are true and some of them are not. It's about the woolly bear caterpillar.
The famous woolly bear. Everybody is an expert on them.
Yeah.
And they will come racing to you and announce that because of whatever it's doing that week, it has predicted the weather.
And the question is, does it predict the weather? I don't even think weathermen can predict the weather, so I don't know about woolly bears, right?
Yeah. This edition also goes into the actual life cycle of the woolly bear and its other phases.
Yeah, I've always wondered about that, so I think this is going to be a really great one.
I'm looking forward to it. We're here with Joe Bain, owner of Bain's Best Perennials, a wholesale perennial plant nursery in Malden Bridge in Columbia County. Joe's been very generous with the Master Gardener Volunteer Program over the years. He's taught classes on perennials to the trainees, and he's sold us plants at wholesale prices for our plant sales and even donated plants from time to time. Welcome, Joe. It's a pleasure to spend some time with you. Thanks for coming in to help us learn more about perennials. Let's start with a little history. You started your nursery in Malden Bridge in 1988, is that right?
That's right.
Okay, tell us a little about yourself and the nursery.
Well, thank you for having me. I actually grew up in the agricultural business. My family, George and Louise, and my sister Nancy and I bought a dairy farm in Malden Bridge, which is really where the nursery still exists, back in 1963. So I was raised in agriculture and saw everybody get their feet on the floor at 5:30 in the morning to do milking and all that stuff. And so they milked the farm from 63 to July of 69, and they sold the farm off on that side of the street, and we moved over to what would be the eastern side of Route 66, and that's where my nursery is today. But, yeah, so just lots of livestock and agriculture, and then I slid over into the plant business, which is a little bit more easily maintained than livestock.
Why did you choose perennials?
Perennials have always been kind of suited to my personality. busy in the spring, summer, and the fall, and then completely relaxed for the winter. That lifestyle was kind of my lifestyle. And then as you study plants, trees, shrubs, lichens, whatever it might be, you realize that, oh, these plants are beautiful, and they're completely in sync with my own life.
Yeah. I'm happy it's a beauty thing, Joe, and it's not just about your lifestyle. You would have, like, feet of clay. I would have been upset with you.
It definitely is a beauty thing. There's no question.
But it's a wholesale business. You don't sell retail, right?
Exactly right. We're wholesale, so we're farm to the landscape trade, who then install into homeowners.
So you're usually dealing with landscape designers and people
exactly.
like that?
Exactly, yep. Extensive plant lists. People come and pick up with their trailers and trucks.
So when I come into your nursery, there's so many perennials. How many perennials do you have that you usually grow?
I think right now we're about 480 types, and the normal inventory runs somewhere between 21,000 and 28,000.
Wow, that's amazing.
And it's interesting that the sales and the production basically are almost the same, so that number actually never changes.
Oh.
We don't ever plummet down to real low or extremely high. This is natural balance that...
But there's times that certain plants are available and certain plants are not, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yep. If we run out of something, many times you can't replace it until, you know, the following year.
And is that because of how you grow from seed? Do you grow from plugs? Like, what's your usual
method? It really depends on the individual plant, but many times there's an ideal starting point for most things and a finishing point, and you really can't change those two things too much. There's a little bit of wiggle room. Other plants, you can do three or four times a year. And just keep recycling them in if they're really fast. Salvias are a really good example. All those salvias, you can do them the last day of March. You can do them every 6 or 8 weeks into pots.
But your heavy planting season is what? Like February, March, April?
We plant from probably the last couple of days of March right through October. There's not a week that goes by that we're not.
Do you do more plugs than seed?
So we do plants from our own seed in that one small greenhouse as much as we can. A lot of things come easily from seed. And then everything else that's cuttings we'll purchase, but it comes in as a plug.
Right.
And then also bare roots. Bare roots are tremendous
bare root, amount. Yeah.
Springtime.
Yep.
There's a certain point where when you get into the middle or late May, you want to be done with your bare roots, have those in pots. And then we can do bare roots again when we get into September where it cools off a little bit, where they can root in. And have good success that way.
And do you collect your own seed, or do you basically, you're buying seed?
Oh, sure. Oh, yeah, that's some of the fun. There's certain things
great.
You can collect pretty easily from plants that I have at my house, plants at the nursery, plants on the side of the road.
Like what kinds of plants do you collect the seed of?
A bunch of native things.
Coneflowers or?
No, I don't collect any coneflowers. Huh. We purchase all of those because the seed has to be exactly
true to seed.
Yeah, there's a whole host of things. Rebecca's, asters from the side of the road, Cupertorium, Hyssopifoliums, Heterotheca villosa, which is really hard to find.
What is that? Well,
Heterotheca is actually a golden aster.
Oh, okay.
It grows a good four and a half feet tall. And
does it look like a goldenrod to the casual eye?
No, it looks like an aster that's completely yellow.
I got to make a note.
That's a plant that you planted. You sold
Tim got some last time you were there.
It's super rugged, right? It's
super
crazy.
Super rugged, that's right. Yes.
So when I drive along the county roads and I see a crazy person picking seed, that's you, right?
Probably. There's a lot of crazy people
that's
out there.
That's true.
I don't. But in the fall, I do carry a pair of scissors and paper bags in my car.
We do that too.
And notations.
Okay, so now here's the question. Do you keep all your seeds in a candy box or a canning jar? Things like I do.
Oh, sure. Yeah, you know, they get cleaned and sorted, labeled.
Oh, I don't do that part.
And put in the fridge.
Oh, yeah, I do that with a lot of them.
You do need to label them as to what they are because you think you'll remember what this is. And so the date you collect it. And what it is, that's really all you need.
And how do you even sort through what you're going to plant, what you're going to buy? Like, how do you decide what's on your list?
That's what we do in the middle of the winter.
Uh-huh.
And of course, over the course of the year, all my landscape customers, gardeners are coming and going, and we're having conversations. And many times they'll go like, oh, you need to grow this. Today is really great. I love
fashion.
This plant, and I can't find it. Yes, it's very fashion. So I've learned to take those notes, just really quick, scribble it down, pin it back on the board.
So there's kind of in plants that are in this year?
Sure.
Yeah. Yep. What's the most requested this year? Do you have, I want to know what it
there's
is.
There's a peony I'm listing after.
Yeah. Is there something that people have been going crazy over this year or just a bunch of different things?
It's a real broad spectrum. Mm. I can't think of anything off the top of my head. I have to go to my notes.
Yeah.
Because it's really overwhelming as to how much stuff comes at you.
I know
all
I've been trying to convince Joe to plant more goldenrod, solidago, and he's just resistant.
Well, I can understand that.
Yeah. It's the best. It's a great plant.
Has it become a noxious weed in England where they grow it on purpose? It can be really aggressive.
Yeah, there are different types, but I'm going to just defend goldenrod here.
Fine.
Sure. There's many, many varieties of it that are great.
Of course, it has to sell. So
right.
You come in and buy three pots of something I have 100 of, and then those are the 97 sit and become weedy.
I want to know how you keep everything watered in the summer, because that must be a huge challenge, right?
This last year was super easy because it seemed like it rained every third or fourth day. Not so much that it was a real problem, but we have an automatic irrigation system. It's in now three different zones, and it clicks on every other day. Runs from 2 in the morning till 6 in the morning. I get there, I never see it turned on.
Oh, so you don't, I mean, do you hand water as well?
Oh, sure, especially in brand new things.
Oh, the babies.
Absolutely. Yeah, once a baby goes into a pot, and then it's usually on a wagon, so it's got to get watered, and then we park it off someplace, and they root in 3 or 4 weeks out there on the wagon, so you have to go back to the wagons because we don't have irrigation out there. And once it's ready, once it's full, then it goes into the nursery, and it's kind of a finished product.
So it's the pre-nursery nursery.
There you go. Yeah, kind of, right. Yeah.
And you probably have more people working with you in the summer than, say, at this time of year, right?
Yeah, exactly. Nobody's here with me now. But springtime, there's 6 or 7 of us, plus myself. And then in the summer, they kind of all disperse out into other jobs. And I'll usually run the place with just myself and 2 people each day.
And, of course, your dogs, right?
The dogs.
The famous mascots.
Oh, the dogs.
The mascots.
Ginger was the original. Yeah, she was Ginger's the original corgi. And now I've got those 2 terrors, Johnny and June. So we're building a pen for them because they are too rambunctious.
This is the reason why I go to Joe's place.
Oh, not a corgi is worth the trip from anywhere.
Yeah.
Well, absolutely. Now Ginger's famous. She's been immortalized in our cookbook. You got the Ginger soup.
Let me ask you something. I always wonder, at the end of the year, I know you have kind of a sale at the end of the year, but do you overwinter some of your plants?
Oh, my
too?
Goodness, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, we're probably sitting on about, I would say, somewhere north of 21,000. It never drops below kind of around that figure.
And how do you do that? How do you overwinter your plants?
So, it's basically just like in your garden, everything gets cut back. In this case, it's in pots. So they all get pushed together into these beds. It's a concrete block in configuration with ground cover under it. And so they all get put together, they all get counted, and then it's a microfoam overwintering blanket gets put on top, and then 2 layers of white plastic. Yep. So it's this little short bed that's about 10 inches tall, 10 feet wide by 60 feet long.
And do you lose plants in the spring? I mean, some?
The only time we lose plants is really from the rodents. There's 3 things out there, the moles, the voles, and the field mice.
Uh-huh.
They're all active all winter, which I still can't believe. Mm-hmm. Everything else seems to hibernate. Why not you guys?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they are out there, and they're looking for...
And they eat the entire plant, or they just...
It's really funny. I've learned now to... all depending on the exact plant, but many times they'll tunnel in from the bottom. And just eat the root system, but the crown will still be there. So it's a mess, and it doesn't happen often, but you can kind of just pick the plants out, pick the crowns out, clean it, and just repot and just reset the plug back in there, and it'll re-root. So you really don't lose the plant. You just have to
lose time.
Yeah, you need to be really as efficient as you can with your time.
Have you found that there are more gardeners and you have more activity with COVID?
COVID really jumped things. I think the first year, which would have been, 2020, we went up 30%.
Just because more people are out in their gardens.
Exactly.
Wow.
All these people that never gardened before or most of them hiring gardeners.
Yeah.
They weren't necessarily doing it themselves. But it was quite a surprise.
Yeah. Now, this brings a question to mind that we should have asked earlier on. Let's do a definition of a perennial. We're happily chortling and talking about perennials, but our listeners don't necessarily know what the definition is.
Sure. Yeah. So perennials, it's kind of easy. It's your lawn. Your lawn's a perennial. My dad used to joke that all these ornamental flowering plants are just educated weeds.
It's true. That's a great definition.
It's really, really kind of nails it. They're just educated weeds. And perennials are plants that die down to the ground and come back next spring.
And some are woody and some are not, right?
Right. Most everything we grow, almost everything, is herbaceous. So that means that they're dying right to the top of the ground. And all their live buds and so forth are sitting there ready to go.
So you have these amazing plants that are incredibly healthy. And if I were out there and I wanted to buy your plants, I'd have to have a garden designer, right? Or go to a plant sale, because I know you sell to a lot of not-for-profits and people like us when we have a plant sale, right?
Exactly, yep. The Master Gardener programs in all the counties around us. And garden clubs, a lot of garden clubs. The Garden Club of America folks.
Right.
So there's quite a few. And that's almost all springtime. It's really spring heavy.
Oh, sure, for the sales.
The month of May is nutty as far as those deliveries to plant sales or picks up.
But now every little plant has a tag in it, and you do a great job on that. When I go to one of the big box stores, if I'm lucky, there's a tag in it, and if I'm really lucky, it's the right tag. So your information in your plants, those pots have absolutely vital information.
Right, especially the tags that we can make in-house. So when I sit down at the computer, I can do the text and try and hit on.
So it's geared for us locally.
Exactly.
That makes a big difference.
Yep, exactly.
Yeah.
If I'm a new gardener and I'm thinking about making a perennial bed, that's something that you would use, obviously, as a tool. But do you have any other advice for, like, if I'm a gardener and I want to start with some really easy perennials, like, what's your advice? What do you think are the easiest perennials?
The basic top 10.
It really is, depends on what you like. Now with the internet, you can find so much so quickly. And it's still the same old thing. It's garden catalogs and maybe what you grew up with, what you recognize, colors, certain things like that. But
what are you selling the most of? What are people coming in and asking for? I need to know the trends.
It's almost always
iris.
Things that are in bloom.
Right.
In
whatever's
season.
In bloom that day.
So it's phlox paniculata when phlox paniculata is in bloom.
Yep.
Or it's phlox subulata when, it's April and May. People are flocking to your door because they see it in their neighbors or wherever they're seeing things. And it's just a progression. So that question is almost impossible
to
answer.
That's true. No, but I think that is the answer.
It changes
what's flowering
weeks,
that day?
Weeks to week.
I know when we have plant sales, we go to Joe's and pick what's blooming because people just don't want to buy something that's not in bloom, right?
Exactly.
What about deer-resistant plants? I mean, did you get a lot of questions about that?
All the time.
Yeah.
Yep. And I used to kind of have a sort of list, way back in college. So my college was – I went to BCC over in Pittsfield. Mm-hmm. I took a skip year out of high school and studied environmental sciences, and that's when I learned that all of these things have names, which I never had actually realized that every plant has a name. And then a couple of years after that, I went to Farmingdale for horticulture and then off to Cornell for two more years after that. So what I learned, I think, at Farmingdale was that deer-resistant plants are still ferns, ornamental grasses, and silver-foliaged plants. And after that, there is no rule.
Right.
They eat whatever is.
They ate my peonies one year.
Yeah.
Yes. I think a lot of times it's the little ones as mama, mom and two or three.
Oh, taste testing.
Going through your yard. The little ones are taste testing. Exactly.
But what about like mints?
We're fenced off.
Right.
We have a 7-foot fence around the whole place because whatever they're not eating, they're walking on.
Yes.
So they leave their mark behind, so I got to clean that up.
Like,
never fail. So
mountain mint or bee balm or something like that, they never seem to touch my garden. But I don't know if you've found people tell you that they do.
Tim, I rarely grow plants outside my nursery.
Right.
So I don't have the expertise as to what happens in a garden that's completely open.
And
it's difficult, but there's all those things. It's the rabbits, it's the woodchucks, it's the deer,
right?
It's your neighbor's dog. It's a
jungle out there.
Yeah, what do we do about that?
Just keep planting is what happens.
You just kind of
have that moment of where you want to scream, and it's like, all right, let's just grow something else.
And what about shade versus sun plants? I know you have a lot of shade plants. Like, you have a lot of hookeras and a lot of beautiful shade plants. I mean, do you find that a lot of people come in and designers looking to do shade
gardens?
Very
much, especially dry shade.
Mm-hmm.
So it's ferns, epimediums, hellebores.
I adore epimediums.
not natives.
Oh, yeah, and there's so many.
You could and just, they want to be daffodils. When you look at the plant flowers really close, they're just so cool.
Yep. I've seen a couple that are really pushing their flowering more
really?
Than the foliage. So I think we're going to find some really, really good
my list is getting really long
epimediums
over here,
that will
John.
Kind of wow you more because they're so subtle.
Yep. Well, and I know that you have garden designers come in and ask you for specific plants, but are you in the winter looking at, oh, this is the epimedium, this is the new one that's out there?
Sure.
And that, I mean, so you're looking at catalogs
and sometimes
like
it
that.
Might be, you can see it this year, but it may not be available,
yep.
you know, in the pipeline as far as propagation.
Right.
So you kind of have to keep that notation, and then eventually it'll pop up on somebody's list somewhere, a propagator that's growing it where you can buy it in volume.
And I know, you know, I'm kind of a crazy person about planting natives, and I know that you have a big selection of different native plants. Are you getting a call for that? Is that something that's
my goodness,
trending?
Yes. Yeah, we got drugged down that road about 10 years ago where people come in looking for goldenrods, and
mm-hmm.
I'm like, you must be out of your mind
because
it's everywhere.
Right.
But they want specific ones, ones that are maybe a little more ornamental, mm-hmm. white ones and so forth. Asters, of course, have gone through the roof.
Phlox, right.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I know you have a lot of different coneflowers and a lot of different bee balm.
It's been I won't say difficult, but unusual that for so many years, like, you know, you go through hort school and you learn to grow all these cultivated things,
right.
cultivars of this, that, the next thing. And then the native thing came back and, like, they don't want this echinacea that's, you know, cultivated
right.
and crossed and
yeah,
blah, blah, blah.
Fancy
they
colors.
Want the original.
Mm-hmm.
So
right.
now you have to go back and grow the original
right,
plants.
Right. This kind of the straight plant, yeah.
Right.
Because
exactly.
they've done so much kind of somersaulting in their hybridizing that they've kind of hybridized out the pollen and all of that, right?
In some cases,
yeah.
Sure. Yeah. Again,
yeah.
you have to talk about actual specifics.
Yeah.
Of plants, but
what kind of percentage do you think of your plant stock now is more natives or native-ish?
We try to use the term improved natives. These things all are good pollinators. They all still set seed. The birds still eat them. Yeah, it's not the exact plant that we started with 30 years ago. But the percentage, it's hard to say, you know, maybe 30%.
Yeah,
if being
in your nursery, that's what I would guess. And
yep.
I mean, you really have a big selection of natives.
That helps a lot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, you don't necessarily identify them as natives. I noticed, like, at the big box stores, they don't either. They just have those plants, maybe, as opposed to specialty nurseries that do. Right.
Yeah, there are nurseries that do nothing but native plant. And that definition is a little bit wonky. When was it a native? Where's your starting point? What's your definition thereof? But
I'm encouraged by that, that people
started,
are starting
good.
To, yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Really,
yeah.
And designers as well. There's some specific designers that really focus on that, right?
Yes, exactly.
So one of the big issues that we have in this county are the Asian jumping worms, and
mm-hmm.
I know your plants never have them. I don't know. How do you kind of guard against that? What do you do about that?
So all of our soil comes in, been composted, heated to a certain degree. We get it from McEnroe Organic down in Millerton, New York. So it comes in free of any of that, and then they go into pots, and then the pots are on a ground cover.
Right.
So there's really – they never actually touch the earth itself.
That's really important, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I realize the crazy worm is the problem.
And people have been asking you about it, I'm sure, right?
Yes. Yep.
So
I've had landscapers come in and physically dump out 20 pots to check for worms.
Wow.
And I will tell them, it's like, all right, go ahead, have a good time. You're not going to find – but, you know,
it's
hopefully you don't find them.
The
but,
way you're growing, it's kind of impossible for you to have them. And that's really important for the nursery industry, right?
Probably never impossible, but certainly the percentage is very, very, very low.
Right.
So you can't casually bring in a load of topsoil or a load of anything. You have to be very careful,
exactly.
And it has to be you have to know that it's been sterilized in some form,
right?
If
we bring in like a 10-yard load of double grind mulch, which we use for my home around the nursery, it's always dumped on a tarp underneath and then covered on all physically on all four sides.
Well, and speaking of kind of ecologically minded, I know one of the things you do, which I think is great, is you do pot recycling. So folks can bring in their pots. I know I've done this, and you do reuse a lot of them, right?
Absolutely. Just knock the soils out of them. In that case, it's not soil again. It's
right.
It's these composted mixes. If something is really dirty, it goes on to recycling.
Mm-hmm.
But reuse pots up until they're broken. This last 2 years now, getting pots because of the supply chain and COVID and so forth, huge increased demands.
I know that you don't sell retail, but you do have the famous wagon, right?
The roadside plant wagon.
Tell
has
us
its own
about
life.
That. Yeah, tell us. So people can come and buy plants.
So somewhere along late April, when things start to really, when we have some cold, hardy vegetables that are ready, and of course, ground flocks and other sort of things that are in bloom, we have a 8x16 hay wagon. We load it up with plants, pull it down the edge of the road, and people drop the money in the box, and there's a little parking space. And I can kind of see the wagon from my nursery, and you just see people coming and going all day.
That's
it
great.
Took a while, but now it's really become
it's kind of famous,
some
right?
kind of a destination. Yeah, it is a little famous.
Excellent.
Oh, it's wonderful.
Every week it's different stuff.
Great.
Yeah,
excellent.
All the way through April through. I think the last time we had it was almost the 1st of November. I pulled it up for the last time.
So sure. Stop by the wagon. Right?
If you can find Malden.
Malden Bridge, yep.
Then you can find the wagon.
Yep.
So that sounds like a great stopping point for us. What do you think, Gene? You have any more questions?
I have 1,000 more questions.
You do.
But we've filled all the time we have, and it's always a delight.
Thanks so much for taking your time and joining us,
Joe.
It's
been
my
pleasure.
Appreciate
this
it.
Has been fun.
Thanks, Joe.
You're listening to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Stay tuned for Good Plant, Bad Plant.
Welcome back to Good Plant, Bad Plant, where we focus on two plants per episode, one that is ecologically valuable, and one plant on the other end of the spectrum that is invasive or noxious weed. Thus, good plant, bad plant. I'm your host, Tim Kenalty. In this episode, I'm going to talk about one of my favorite groups of plants, the Monardas. Monardas are a genus of flowering plants in the mint family. Most of the cultivars you can buy at your local nursery are one of either of two species native to the eastern United States, Monarda fistulosa, or wild bergamot, and Monarda didyma, or bee balm. And as the name implies, bee balm is an incredibly important pollinator plant. Monarda hybrids can be found in a wide assortment of sizes and colors, from dark red to vibrant pink to even a deep purple. And because they're members of the mint family, Monarda are really easy to care for, best grown in medium to wet, rich soil in full sun. Although Monarda fistulosa can take some drought. Monardas are clump-forming and spread well, but they're not too aggressive, and very easy to divide and transplant. Two other great features are that they have a long bloom time, often up to 8 weeks in midsummer, and they're seldom bothered by rabbits or deer. But maybe most importantly, they are amazing pollinator flowers, often covered in a variety of bees and butterflies. To many species of swallowtails in my garden, they seem to be almost irresistible. They're also a big favorite with ruby-throated hummingbirds and hummingbird clearwing moths. I do a lot of photography in my garden, and one of the first flowers I head to when I'm looking for butterflies are Monardas. The only downside may be that some Monarda cultivars are more prone to mildew, especially as we get later into the season. I'm going to include with the transcript a link to Mount Cuba's website. Mount Cuba is an amazing online resource for native plants. I'm including a link to a trial they did of 40 cultivars of Monarda. The trial rated all kinds of characteristics, like habitat, floral display, and disease resistance. This should make choosing the right Monarda for your garden that much easier. So for beautiful, long-blooming, carefree flowers that attract a wide range of pollinators, you really can't go wrong with Monardas. Okay, now for the bad plant. I don't know if you're like me, but there are some plants that just get under my skin. For me, one of those is Japanese stiltgrass. I just have a thing about this plant. And if you're not looking closely, you may not even know that you have it in your garden, but it seems to be ubiquitous in many people's yards and gardens. Japanese or Asian stiltgrass is an annual grass that's native to China, Japan,
Korea, and India. And unlike many invasive plants that were brought to the U.S. intentionally, silkgrass got established by accident. It's thought to have been introduced since 1919 in packing materials in a shipment of porcelain to Tennessee, and it's since spread to most of the eastern half of the United States. Silkgrass is considered one of the most damaging invasive plant species in the country. It can spread rapidly because it thrives in a variety of light conditions, including deep shade. Each plant can produce up to 1,000 seeds, and the seeds are viable in the soil for up to 5 years. Silkgrass is not preferred or frequently eaten by grazers like deer, goats, or horses, and it doesn't really have any natural enemies or controls. It's also thought to be allelopathic, in other words, it inhibits growth of seedlings of other plants. So all of those characteristics have allowed it to form, in many cases, these huge stands or monocultures that can negatively impact native plant diversity, reduce wildlife populations, and disrupt ecosystems. How do you know if you have silkgrass? It emerges in the late spring to midsummer and has pale green, lance-shaped leaves with silver stripes, somewhat resembling bamboo. As for any invasive plant species, the best control is early detection. You can hand pull small infestations, but you may need to consider other methods if you have a large area of silkgrass. I'm going to include some great links to help you both identify silkgrass and get a handle on at least reducing it. If you think you have it, I encourage you to do a bit of research because it's always better to know your foe. And that's a wrap for today's edition of Good Plant, Bad Plant. As always, if you're really looking to support birds, butterflies, and bees, plant natives, and look out for those invasives.
You're listening to Nature Calls, conversations from the Hudson Valley. Stay tuned for Hits and Myths.
Welcome back to another episode of Hits and Myths. Have you heard people say something like, "Look at that woolly bear. Such broad bands of black, that means we're in for a tough winter." I have. The cute, fuzzy, woolly bear caterpillars grow up to be Isabella tiger moths, an orange moth with a fuzzy leaf and small black spots on its wings and body. All butterflies and moths spend some time as caterpillars before becoming adult butterflies or moths. A quick detour, what makes butterflies different from moths? It's not really a scientific distinction, but a popular one. They're all members of the same scientific grouping, the order Lepidoptera. We tend to love the colorful ones who flit about during the day and are much less familiar with those who are active at night. So, in general, butterflies have larger, brightly colored wings and fly in the day. Moths are duller and fuzzier, have wings that are smaller compared to their thicker bodies, and fly at night. Also, butterflies often rest with their wings folded up so they touch. Moths tend to rest with their wings open to the sides. All butterflies and moths go through a metamorphosis when the caterpillar makes a cocoon or chrysalis about itself. And while the animal is inside, it changes from caterpillar to moth or butterfly, including growing wings. The silkworm, which is a moth caterpillar, not a worm, secretes the fiber to make its cocoon entirely from its own body. People turn that into silk. Other moths use bits of leaves or other stuff to help build their cocoons, and some do their metamorphosis underground. The woolly bears have two generations each year. Some hatch from their eggs in May and some in August. The caterpillars eat many kinds of leaves, including some garden plants, some weeds, and some true leaves. Woolly bears do all of their eating while they're caterpillars. The Isabella tiger moths do not eat. In the fall, the caterpillars look for a sheltered space to hibernate, like a gap in a rock pile. That's why you most often see them in the fall. They're on the move, looking for a good spot. They hibernate as caterpillars, not in cocoons. They make their own antifreeze and will almost freeze solid. When spring comes, the woolly bears come out of their winter spots and make their cocoons. Inside the cocoon, they do their big transformation. When it leaves the cocoon as a moth, it has a short life remaining. The moths use their wings to find mates and lay eggs. So, can they predict the weather? It's a nice story, but no. How can we be sure? There are a few reasons. First, there's lots of color variation between caterpillars. If you collected a bunch of woolly bears, you might see some with wide black bands and some with narrow black bands, but they're all going into the same winter. Second, the colors on each caterpillar changes as it eats different food, but they eat many kinds of plants, so the kind of color change is happening all the time for woolly bears. Woolly bears who are close neighbors might be changing foods in ways that make for opposite changes in color. Third, there are closely related species that are much more black or much more brown, so looking at those would throw off the prediction. Fourth, and possibly most important, the woolly bears predicting weather myth is itself kind of woolly. Some versions say more black means a colder winter, some say just the opposite, and some say sort of related things, like caterpillars that are woollier are preparing for a colder winter. Basically, no one really wants to pin this down. It's just a fun superstition that's not meant to be taken seriously. We'll find another myth for the next time around.
That concludes another episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. We would like to thank Sandra Linnell and Devin Connolly from Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties for production support. And a special thank you to our listeners for joining us on this episode of Nature Calls, Conversations from the Hudson Valley. You can find links to any of the topics mentioned in this episode at our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org. Comments and suggestions for future topics may be directed to us at colgremg@cornell.edu or on the CCE Master Gardener Volunteers of Columbia and Greene Counties Facebook page. For more information about Cornell Cooperative Extension of Columbia and Greene Counties, visit our website at ccecolumbiagreen.org or visit us in Hudson or in Acre. Cornell Cooperative Extension provides equal programming and employment opportunities.